You're listening to a Midori House US election special broadcast live from New York City on the 5th of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to a Midori House US election special coming to you live from New York City with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Aisha Spears.
With less than 24 hours to go until election day itself, the presidential candidates are crisscrossing the nation, making their final appearances in a string of swing states.
We'll be doing the same, checking in with correspondents in Ohio, Wisconsin, and Florida.
Sasha Eisenberg, our Washington correspondent, will join us in the studio for his take on the final push. And he'll also give us the penultimate installment in his swing state guide.
We've seen this for the last few cycles where Republicans think that Michigan looks winnable, but end up pulling out. And I think that the state's still a fundamentally Democratic state.
Then we're off to the tiny Kenyan village of Kogelo, home to Barack Obama's grandmother, Mama Sarah, a place where residents can say with certainty that they are better off than they were 4 years ago.
We have seen good roads. We have the electricity and water. So that is the change we have got since Obama became the president of America.
And we'll be asking, can Romney win? Pollster Julia Clark from Ipsos will be here to explain how he can get 270 electoral college votes.
One day to go until the world's most important election. We'll cover it all right here on our Midori House US election special, live from New York on Monocle 24.
But first, over to London to get the latest news headlines with Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. Barack Obama and Mitt Romney are making a last push to woo undecided voters in crucial swing states as the race for the White House enters its final day. The presidential candidates are squeezing in as many campaign appearances as possible during the final hours before Tuesday's election. Nationwide polls show the men to be locked in one of the closest presidential races in recent American history. The Republican candidate, Mr. Romney, has been delivering his final arguments to voters in Florida.
Tomorrow we begin a new tomorrow. Tomorrow we begin a better tomorrow. This nation is going to begin to change for the better tomorrow. Your work is making a difference. The people of the world are watching, and now we're close. The door to a brighter future is open. It's waiting for us.
NATO Secretary General Anders Rasmussen is calling last month's parliamentary election in Ukraine a step backwards for democracy. Several international observers have criticized the elections. Observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe say there was misuse of state money and resources and biased media coverage in the run-up to the polls. Mr. Rasmussen voiced his concerns at his regular monthly press conference in Brussels.
Let me tell you that I'm very concerned about the situation in Ukraine. It's clear that the parliamentary elections constituted a step backwards for Ukrainian democracy. I think Ukraine deserves strong democratic institutions and a political system that respects the rule of law. And these elections did not advance those causes.
New York's Attorney General has launched an investigation into hundreds of complaints of prices being increased in the aftermath of Storm Sandy. Eric Schneiderman says the largest number of complaints are about increased fuel prices, but other emergency supplies have also been affected. Meanwhile, New Yorkers are being warned to stock up and stay indoors as a new storm threatens to batter the U.S. East Coast after Superstorm Sandy. Gusts from the northeast of up to 55 miles an hour are expected by Wednesday, bringing the threat of more heavy rain, snow and flooding. A car bomb at a military checkpoint in the Syrian city of Hama has killed at least 50 soldiers and pro-regime fighters. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the blast happened near the village of Ziyara in central Syria. The organisations claiming the attack was carried out by Jabhat al-Nusra, an Islamic militant group which supports al-Qaeda. Interior ministers from around the world are calling for a stronger Interpol to help prevent the increase of terrorist acts. Pakistan's and India's interior ministers have been meeting on the sidelines of the Interpol General Assembly in Rome. A court in Cyprus has remanded three British tourists in custody on suspicion of fatally stabbing an off-duty British soldier in a nightclub. Cypriot police say four off-duty soldiers stationed on the island were involved in a fight with three tourists in the early hours of Sunday morning. One of the tourists is alleged to have drawn a knife and stabbed the teenage soldier. A Vatican computer expert has appeared before a court in a trial that could shed light on whether Pope Benedict's former butler acted alone in leaking sensitive documents or was a pawn in a bigger power struggle. Claudio Schiappoletti is accused of aiding and abetting the butler, Paolo Gabriele, who was sentenced to 18 months in jail for aggravated theft last month. Irish Times correspondent Paddy Agnew was in court.
What's interesting was that the Pope's butler himself, Paolo Gabriele, who's one of the witnesses in this trial, he was in court, and he seemed to be rather more relaxed about the whole thing than Claudio Schiappoletti, because Schiappoletti basically looked pretty... not particularly happy. He wasn't a happy camper this morning.
Malawi's justice minister has announced that laws against same-sex relationships have been suspended pending a decision on whether to repeal the legislation. Police have been ordered not to arrest or prosecute homosexuals until Parliament has debated the new proposal. At present, homosexual acts carry a maximum sentence of 14 years in jail. Some Western leaders have suggested they'll cut aid to African countries who fail to recognise gay rights. And that's the latest Monocle 24 news.
Bill Bingham, thank you very much indeed. It is 18:06 in London, 13:06 on the East Coast. You're listening to a Midori House US election special live from New York on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
It absolutely is Monocle 24. You're listening to a US election special, Midori House, here in New York City, with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Aisha Spears. Hello, Aisha.
Hello, we're in the same room for the first time of these election specials. It's
yes.
Very nice to see you in New York.
It's very good to be here. Yeah, it's great to finally be here. We obviously had planned to be here somewhat earlier, but Hurricane Sandy somewhat prevented our departure. And it's been an interesting weekend to be in New York and see some of the recovery. You got out of the city, didn't you?
I did. I decided to escape having no electricity and no power and no heat, and so I went to Philadelphia, which I know some of our, well, at least one of our guests today knows very well. It was my first time in Philadelphia. It was also one of my first times of this election campaign that I've seen so many ads, which we're just not used to here in New York, because we're not, our vote, well, I'm English, so obviously my vote doesn't count whatsoever. But the vote,
yes,
for New York,
really.
Exactly. The vote in New York doesn't, is clearly not as important as Pennsylvania. So there are lots of ads going back and forth, which is entertainment in itself.
I also had my fill of political TV. I spent an evening watching Fox News.
Entertainment, not news, really, is it?
Can I just say, wow, wow. I mean, it's I'd heard about it. I'd seen bits of it before, but my word. Watching Sean Hannity and Karl Rove, who I believe used to work for a man called George W. Bush, talk about the response to Hurricane Sandy and about how outrageous it was, and this made Barack Obama the worst president in history, was quite amusing. Also, it was nice to know that I'm apparently not just a member, according to Sarah Palin, of the lamestream media, but also now it's the corrupt media, because apparently we haven't been covering the scandal over the foreign donations to the Obama campaign, a scandal which, once you actually look into, is revealed to be one Norwegian man who might have donated $10. There we are. So that was Fox News. That was...
Are you sure you weren't watching the SNL segment of Fox and Friends, which is so close to the real thing that it doesn't even become a parody almost?
It could have been. It could have been. It was quite close. Now we have two wonderful guests with us here in New York. Let's start with Sasha Eisenberg, our Washington correspondent. Sasha, hello.
Hello. How are you?
Very good indeed. We're going to be talking to you about a number of things over the next 45, 50 minutes. But I want to start by talking about the ground game, the get out of the vote, which everyone right now across the country is really focused on. How does it actually work? Is it simply a case of knocking on doors and saying, you said you were going to vote for us, you know, can I give you a lift to the polls?
There's more to it now than that, although that's sort of at the core of it still. So the big challenge that a campaign has over the course of a year is to basically sort the voters that they care about into two groups. There are people who are regular voters, the types of people who vote, and you're not certain they're going to support you. They show up as undecided in polls. They're soft supporters of your opponents and you want to get them to defect. They're soft supporters of yours and you want to shore up their support. And those are the people you want to persuade. And that's what all those TV ads you're seeing are about. That's what most of these campaign events and the sort of news that the candidates are trying to make every day. And then there's mobilization, which is the game of getting people who like your candidate or sort of on your team. They identify with your party, they're part of your coalition, but they're just not habitual voters. It's just not something that they do. And so the goal of campaigns is to, historically just been basically reminding them and then giving them information on where and how you vote, and then logistical help like rides and stuff like that. In some places, help with absentee ballots or early voting where there's sort of a technical threshold. But increasingly, campaigns become a lot more sophisticated in understanding the psychology behind motivating voters. And so what a lot of these interactions are about is finding new ways to make voting a meaningful experience for people.
Now, over the last few days, you've been out with some of the campaigns, seeing what they're doing. Who seems to be doing it right and who seems to be doing, taking advantage of new technologies, new innovations?
You can't even begin to calculate how significant the gap is right now between how the left does politics and how the right does politics. And, I think a lot of the media coverage of this and some of the trash talking between the campaigns and the parties takes the form of sort of measuring the scope or volume of their activities. So it's, we have 130 field offices and Ohio says the Obama campaign, the Ryan people only have 40, whatever. Then the Republican National Committee will say, well, we knocked on 800,000 doors this weekend. First of all, the offices, they don't make up the number for. The other stuff, I think there's good reason that people believe people just like fabricate entirely. But if you have an understanding of the sort of technique involved, you understand there's a lot better use of data, statistical modeling to make assumptions about the voters you've not interacted with over the course of the campaign. It's really, the goal of every campaign would be to spend the year interviewing voters individually and asking who are you going to vote for so that I have the certainty of knowing. You can't do that. No campaign has the time or resources, and people just don't answer their phone or come to their door and tell you. So the question is how you use data to extrapolate about what the people you haven't yet talked to are going to do, and the Democrats are much smarter about that.
The question of mobilizing voters is a slightly different one here in New York. We were also joined by Caitlin Thompson, who's the political editor of WNYC, the radio station that was getting me through a lot of my last week with a wind-up radio. So I thank you guys for your coverage there very much. But how have you been? How has this last week been for you, covering it within the context of Superstorm Sandy? And also, perhaps it gives you much more to cover in New York State, which perhaps people don't care about so much because it's pretty uncontested.
Yeah, I think some of the stuff that Sasha just hit on is actually totally right on the money, but unexpectedly relevant all of a sudden for us here. A radio station that's used to speaking to New Yorkers and to some degree New Jerseyans. And now you look all of a sudden, our votes don't really matter that much. So most of the way to cover this locally has been a very big challenge for us. So what we've done is tried to do what radio does best, which is find characters, talk to people across the country. We've got a small team of people, but we're really good at sort of sussing out some of the narratives when we've talked to some of these undecided voters that Sasha was just referring to. They're hard to find. They're really hard to tease narratives out of. And so that presents its own host of challenges. And then all of a sudden, you find that the turnout game that Sasha was just referring to, all of a sudden being incredibly meaningful here, where we're used to having, we're the nation's ATM here. Everyone comes here to campaign and to get their money. But we're not used to having our votes be meaningful. And even if our votes aren't meaningful in this election because both of these states are so solidly blue, the question now is, can we even vote? And what sort of mechanism dysfunction does this now expose when a storm has knocked out the ability of two hugely populous states to be able to even cast their votes? So it's a story we've been very, very closely watching, and with risk of sounding a little bit glib, a sort of welcome narrative change for us, because all of a sudden we're talking about something that the rest of the country is watching, as opposed to us trying to sort of wheedle our way into a story that, we don't always have sure footing on.
Caitlin, Sasha, thank you both for now. We'll be talking to you throughout the show. This is a Midori House US election special on Monocle 24. We're off to Wisconsin, Ohio, and Florida right after this.
If you like Subway's not Subway sandwiches, If you want to know what makes a metropolis thrive or take a dive, and if you prefer the concrete jungle to the muddy field, then you need The Urbanist. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we explore the urban landscape by tram, subway and taxi to meet the people out to make urban life even better. In this episode of The Urbanist, we're looking at innovation and design in the urban environment. We're going to be going to Eindhoven, where they're rethinking what the road should look like. We'll ask, is Warsaw the next city ripe for investment? And we're also going to be at the inaugural city summit in Tel Aviv.
Tel Avivians never give up. If something doesn't work, they try again, they try again, they try again, they try again. Which is why Tel Aviv can go through cycles, it can go through dips and peaks. It can be founded on the sand dunes and 100 years later it can be one of the most famous cities in the world.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
This is the Midori House election special with Steve Bloomfield and Aisha Spears.
It certainly is. It's 1816 in London, 1316 here in New York City. Before we head to Wisconsin, Ohio, Florida, let me just give you a flavour of what the schedules for the two campaigns look like today. They are quite something. Mitt Romney is in Orlando. He's in Lynchburg, Virginia, genuinely called Lynchburg. Landmark Aviation in Columbus, Ohio. Then he's got a rally with Kid Rock in Manchester, in New Hampshire. Paul Ryan is in Nevada, Colorado, Iowa, Ohio, Wisconsin. Obama is in Wisconsin as well. Madison will be going there in just one moment. He's then going to Ohio, then to Iowa. Joe Biden, he's not putting in the hours, is he? He's in Virginia twice. That's all he's doing. That's all he's doing. Anyway, as I say, Obama is in Madison, Wisconsin. So is Bruce Springsteen, and so is David Usborne. He joins us there now. Tough gig that, David, covering a Springsteen gig. How was it?
It's funny you mentioned Kid Rock with Mitt Romney there, and if that is an omen for how the election is going, who would you rather have on your side, Kid Rock, no disrespect to Kid Rock fans, or the boss? But yeah, no, it was fun. It was cold, like all the rallies have been for the last few days. I'm frozen to the bone. But it was a pretty energized Barack Obama who came out today, and a crowd of 16,000 people crammed into downtown Madison here underneath the shadow of the Capitol building. And, you know, it was a good rally. This is the last day of campaigning for Barack Obama in his life, as far as we know. He will never campaign again for political office.
And do we think that on the last day, having a Bruce Springsteen concert is, you know, perhaps a nice way for him to kick back a little bit? It's a marathon of a campaign for him. Did he look like he's enjoying himself, or did he look like he was exhausted?
A little bit of both. I stayed in the same hotel as him last night. He got in well after midnight. You know, it is an extremely grueling schedule. But he on the stage last night in Cincinnati, Ohio, he was dancing at the end of it, the president. So I think he's in a pretty good mood.
David Usborne in Madison, Wisconsin, thank you very much. Now let's head to Ohio, where Tim Marshall, foreign affairs editor for Sky News, has based himself for the final few days. Tim, there's been talk that the Romney camp will be campaigning in Ohio right up to the last minute, i.e. tomorrow. What could rallies there tomorrow really do?
Well, let's suppose you are down to one last swing county within what is possibly the key swing state, and you just needed those extra few votes. That's what it's for, because, you know, that's what it's coming down to. I'm still watching the TV ads, which are costing millions of dollars, and they're still playing here. I'm still getting emails from both parties, despite not having a vote, imploring me to vote for them. And that's because they know it is so tight, and they're going after those last few hundred voters. It's funny, you know, if they just obviously wouldn't want this system, but if they just sort of sent them some of the money and didn't play the TV ads, I think that could guarantee the votes.
Do you think these undecided voters, Tim, actually still exist? Can there really be anyone in Ohio who's watched all the ads, who's watched the debates, and then think, you know what, I've no idea who to vote for?
Yes, I do. Although I think, obviously, it's a very, very small amount. I mean, firstly, we've got hundreds of thousands of people here have already voted by postal ballot. Tens of thousands have actually voted in person. And then we've got the rest that are going to show up tomorrow. On Tuesday. Yeah, tomorrow. But within that, there really are this last few. And if it wasn't so tight, they wouldn't matter. You know, the margins would be greater. But I don't believe the polls. I'm absolutely certain there is no way Obama will win this state by as much as 5 points, which he did last time against McCain. It's going to be much, much narrower, whoever wins it. And so I think, yeah, you know, it's a political journalistic cliche, every vote counts. Every vote counts.
Tim, thank you very much indeed, cliches and all. Now, while tomorrow is Election Day, some 30 million Americans have already voted thanks to early voting laws in several states. It's not without controversy, though. Various Republican election officials have tried to make it as difficult as possible for voters to head to the polls. They say it's because of fears of election fraud, but that's not really an argument that stands up to any amount of scrutiny. Ashley Lopez from WLRN is in Miami. Ashley, welcome to Midori House. There have been enormous problems so far in Miami. Talk us through what happened over the weekend.
Well, the Sunday before the election is typically known as a big turnout for minority voters in Florida. But the state legislature here is controlled by Republicans, and they cut that day. But somehow Miami-Dade elections official, you know, contrived a workaround. People would be able to vote using what is usually absentee, you know, vote by mail, but turn it in that day, you know, get the ballot that day and turn it in right there at the polls, almost like voting regularly. But, you know, I don't think this was approved by the mayor at the time, who is Republican-leaning, and he sort of got wind of what was happening. There were hundreds of people outside waiting to vote this way, and he asked that it be shut down, and they shut it down for about an hour, and, you know, people were screaming, hitting the glass, you know, saying, let us vote, because a lot of these people who were there hadn't had a chance to vote early during the week, and, you know, the weekends are one of the only times they have to vote. And so it was just, it was very loud, very contentious, and this is an emotional election for a lot of people, and so an emotional situation just got more so.
Ashley, we've heard a lot about the Latino vote in Florida, but another two voting groups which seem to be making the news at the moment are the Jewish vote and also young first-time voters. Who are you seeing doing a better job with capturing either of those? Obviously, the Jewish vote historically has gone more towards the Democrats, but I know the Romney camp are trying very hard to get them on side. Who do you see as succeeding?
Well, I mean, Obama has, the president has an edge that I think it's going to be hard for anybody to match, you know, from years to come, and especially someone coming in like Mitt Romney. And, you know, and it was very evident at that polling site that I was just talking about in Miami. I mean, because it was such a short notice, it was an impromptu voting day. The only way to reach a mass amount of people was through Facebook. And the Obama campaign had done an amazing job at reaching out to young people saying, well, if you weren't able to vote during the week, you can vote today. And so the people that I was talking to in those lines were, you know, predominantly young people and even young Latino people. So and in Miami, I mean, I don't know if you know this, but the Latino population in parts of Miami-Dade are mostly Cuban, which lean, you know, Republican. So it's very interesting. I think it's going to be hard for any candidate to be as in tune with young first time voters than the president's campaign.
Ashley Lopez from WLRN in Miami, thank you very much for joining us. Sasha, listening to that and looking at where the campaigns are at the moment, are there any surprises about who's campaigning where or where this last-ditch bits of money are going into? I mean, you know, for example, you know, the Republicans seem to be spending an awful lot of money in Pennsylvania in the last two or three days. Does this surprise you at all?
It does. I mean, there's sort of two theories of the case about why Romney and some of his allies in the last week or two have sort of made varying degrees of feints towards Pennsylvania, Michigan, Minnesota, where they had not invested any money in TV all summer, had done very little sort of infrastructure building. You know, those states have closed, I think, to some degree in the public polling, but I think there's sort of two theories of the case. One is that they really are close, and the other one is actually it's a sign of Romney's desperation that there's some sort of desire at the last minute to bizarrely expand the map, because the states that he had invested in had sort of become deadlocked. And, you know, one of the things about Pennsylvania is it's one of the few places in America where you can go buy TV, because neither of the campaigns has been advertising. There's a Senate race that never really got tight. The Republican candidate is wealthy, and so he's put a fair bit of money on TV. But you can go in there in a week out by TV advertising, which is part of the limitations at looking at a map nationally are it's a supply question. There's just not a lot of TV left to buy. There's not a lot of internet advertising to buy. And so I think to some degree their calculations have been shaped by where, you know, the Romney campaign will end this week with money in their bank account, which is a horrible thing for a campaign. So they have money to burn, and you go where you can buy stuff really quickly and easily. And so I think that that's driving some of these calculations.
Caitlin, we've heard a lot of the rhetoric from the Romney campaign being about the fact that, yes, the numbers might not look so good in some swing states, but the Romney supporters are more enthusiastic. They're more passionate than the Obama supporters. You covered the 2008 election. Do you see a kind of waning support and excitement for Obama? Obviously, 2008 was kind of record-breaking, so it was a different type of situation. And do you think that the Romney supporters really do have that much excitement, and that's just what they're saying to make everyone feel better?
Well, I think at this point in the race, it's always a messaging game as much as it's a numbers game. And so it certainly behooves them to indicate that their voters are extremely motivated. And I think to some degree, they're right. I mean, we saw numbers out of North Carolina this week that, you know, a state that Obama carried and ended up carrying by a very thin margin, but largely because he got such great early turnout numbers that are totally going in the opposite direction. So I think that state is totally off of the column, whereas Mitt Romney, you know, I think going into it might not have thought that this was even, you know, a competitive state for him. So I think certainly it's sort of a messaging thing. And obviously, you know, Barack Obama does not have the same sort of enthusiasm. But I think the enthusiasm worries were raised so early among Obama supporters that now there's been the ability combined with the fact that we've had, you know, these debates, the fact that the women's, you know, the women's issue has come up and really, really motivated a lot of people. The a sort of uncovered or undercovered storyline about the Supreme Court being, you know, on the docket of this next president's, you know, abilities to change the landscape has been sort of, I think, more of a last minute motivator. There's no way that it's going to be anything like 2008. It was a, you know, a historic for every reason possible. But I think in terms of, you know, looking at where Obama's the support is shoring up at the end. And you know, an interesting thing that I just want to note that Sasha brought up about the TV ad buys is that the Obama campaign actually ended up doing something really smart that I don't think that necessarily was lauded at the time, which is they took advantage of a lot of early ad buys. And that gave them a lower price, and they picked their states pretty well. And some of the states that we were just hearing from were states that got inundated by these ads in a very concerted effort. And because they came from the president, they were able to be very on message, as opposed to a lot of the, you know, private money that's been funding some of these other ads in swing states that you were talking about hearing over the weekend and in Pennsylvania. So I think that whole strategy game is something that's very, very still unpredictable. And it's also, you know, it's an enthusiasm question. It's also who played their chips right earlier. And, you know, obviously we won't really know until tomorrow night.
I mean, I from a sort of media perspective, I think there are a lot of things that we do really horribly covering these campaigns, but I feel like the sort of stories and punditry about enthusiasm are almost always done wrong, which is,
one is going to say, my supporters aren't enthusiastic.
Well, the campaigns obviously aren't going to say it, but reporters go to a rally of a candidate, right, and then the people are cheering, and then you there are people lined up, and you go interview a half dozen people online to go into a Mitt Romney event. So, people who show up 3 hours early at a state fairground in like late October to go see Paul Ryan or enthusiastic about Paul Ryan, like it is the most insane tautology of like public opinion sampling that you could possibly imagine. And so much of what reporters do is go to campaign events where the candidates are, or go to party events, or, you know, sort of things that are part of the activist culture. And so I don't think that it's a particularly great measure of the sort of ambient enthusiasm of the broad Republican coalition right now, or the broad Democratic coalition, just to go to events. That said, the idea that is sort of, I think, at the core of a lot of the sort of bluster that comes out of the Romney camp and the RNC now, that there's this huge enthusiasm imbalance, whatever that means, between the sort of cores of their coalition, as though black people are not going to turn out at the same rate that rural white, as though black people are not going to turn out for Barack Obama at the same rate that rural old white people are going to turn out for Mitt Romney, seems like an insane assumption to make without a lot to go on.
I want to go back to this point that Caitlin just made about the early ad buys that the Obama campaign did. Sasha, it appears as if there was a bet which the Obama campaign put on, saying, let us go early and go strong and try and paint a picture of Mitt Romney, a negative picture of Mitt Romney, before he has a chance to really settle himself.
Right.
I mean, obviously, we don't know until tomorrow, or maybe even the day after, whether that's worked or not. Do you know, from talking to people within the Obama campaign, do they feel comfortable with that bet that they made.
Yeah, and so I think that are sort of two separate things here. We know more about the first than the latter. The first is the sort of message strategy thing, which is let's define him negatively early. And the way people talked about the costs of that were that Obama had this kind of hope and change positive aura to him. He had surprisingly high personal likability given the approval and the right track number in the country. And there was a feeling that starting in the spring that if he went out and basically played, you know, mean bad guy attacking Mitt Romney, that he would tarnish what people liked about him. They made that gamble. I think they did it very effectively. You could see it in the polls. You can see, you know, Romney is the big surprise is that Romney has bounced back a little in terms of his approval in the last 4 to 6 weeks. But I think that they did that very well. The tactical thing that Caitlin mentions, which is totally right, which is, you know, the barely told story of this campaign, is that they were very savvy about media targeting. It's a very hard story for us to report, either especially the decision making inside the campaign, but even you can sit in a hotel room in Philadelphia and see the TV ads, but understanding who bought what for how much money and is still opaque to us. And so that is going to be something that I think we learn more about in the weeks and months to come.
Sasha, Caitlin, again, thank you very much. You're listening to a Midori House U.S. election special live from New York.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
Esto es Mônaco 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. This is Mônaco 24.
In the next half hour of the program, we'll be visiting Kogelo, the birthplace of Obama's grandmother, to find out what the last 4 years have meant for the tiny Kenyan village. We'll ask Julia Clark from Ipsos what exactly Romney needs to do to win this election, and we'll get our daily guide to the swing states from our partner here in the studio, Sasha Eisenberg. And today we're off to Wisconsin and Michigan.
We've seen this for the last few cycles where Republicans think that Michigan looks winnable, but end up pulling out. And I think that the state's still a fundamentally Democratic state.
But first, back to London, Bill Bingham's got the headlines.
Barack Obama and Mitt Romney are making a last push to woo undecided voters in crucial swing states as the race for the White House enters its final day. The presidential candidates are squeezing in as many campaign appearances as possible during the final hours before Tuesday's election. Nationwide polls show the men to be locked in one of the closest presidential races in recent American history. NATO's Secretary General Anders Rasmussen is calling last month's parliamentary election in Ukraine a step backwards for democracy. Several international observers have criticised the elections. Observers from the Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe say there was misuse of state money and resources and biased media coverage in the run-up to the polls. New York's Attorney General has launched an investigation into hundreds of complaints of prices being increased in the aftermath of Storm Sandy. Eric Schneiderman says the largest number of complaints are about increased fuel prices, but other emergency supplies have also been affected. Meanwhile, New Yorkers are being warned to stock up and stay indoors as a new storm threatens to batter the US East Coast after Superstorm Sandy. A car bomb at a military checkpoint near the Syrian city of Hama has killed at least 50 soldiers and pro-regime fighters. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the blast happened near the village of Ziyara in central Syria. Interior ministers from around the world are calling for a stronger Interpol to help prevent the increase of terrorist acts. Pakistan's and India's interior ministers have been meeting on the sidelines of the Interpol General Assembly in Rome. A court in Cyprus has remanded three British tourists in custody on suspicion of fatally stabbing an off-duty British soldier in a nightclub. Cypriot police say four off-duty soldiers stationed on the island were involved in a fight with three tourists in the early hours of Sunday morning. Malawi's Justice Minister has announced that laws against same-sex relationships have been suspended pending a decision on whether to repeal the legislation. Police have been ordered not to arrest or prosecute homosexuals until Parliament has debated the new proposals. That's the latest Mônaco 24 news.
Bill Bill, thank you very much. It's day four of our Midori House election specials, live from New York on Monocle 24. I'm Steve Bloomfield.
And I'm Aisha Spears. Well, last week we heard from different countries around the globe to find out what the US election means for them. For today's daily report, we have a slightly different focus, Kenya.
When Barack Obama became president, it made history in the most powerful country in the world. Yet for the small, remote Kenyan village of Kegelo, it also changed the course of history. The village, a 10-hour overland journey from the Kenyan capital Nairobi, is the birthplace and resting ground of Barack Obama Sr., the president's father.
Catapulted to international fame after Barack Obama was elected in 2008, the village has been transformed by the attention. With election day quickly approaching, Sarah Christine Jempson went to find out whether residents are counting on the outcome to bring more hope and change.
The village of Kogelo is perched in the rolling hills of western Kenya. Barack Obama's grandmother, Mama Sarah, is one of Kogelo's 6,000 residents. A few streets are named after members of the Obama family. Otherwise, there are few indications that the President of the United States traces his roots to this sleepy village. But despite first impressions, Kogelo has been positively transformed since Obama was elected 4 years ago. Local painter and tile maker George Ochome describes how the Kenyan government immediately invested in basic amenities and infrastructure.
In fact, we are very happy since our son to be the president of America. We have seen a lot of change within our share county. We have seen good roads, we have the electricity and water. So that is the change we have get since Obama became the president of America.
In this region painted green by abundant precipitation, the mud roads regularly become impassable. But with the new paved road, visitors can now easily access Kogelo. This is in part to facilitate access to one of the most famous women in Kenya, Obama's grandmother. Age 90, Mama Sarah's life has been transformed since 2008. After the initial flood of international attention, Mama Sarah no longer speaks to the media. But she still welcomes a steady trickle of visitors on appointment, one-third of which make the pilgrimage from the United States, Europe, Australia, and Japan. This increased traffic has encouraged a local businessman to build a restaurant and 30-room hotel in the village. The establishment provides an extra boost to the local economy. Kogelo's assistant chief, Joseph Ogutu Ojala, explains.
And the moment they come to that hotel for even a seminar or a workshop, then the people at the market center, those who are doing business like shops, they get customers. That hotel is helping everybody here, and even he has employed even our people there.
James Oduor, a local tailor, has seen his business transformed.
After Barack Obama became the president, the center opened for more people, so they have been flocking in. So that made people to come more and more.
But Kogelo's fame has not brought fortune to all. Assistant Chief Ogutu Ojala notes that poverty is still endemic in this region, where most people survive on subsistence farming.
And the rich people can eat well, can go well, can educate their children well, while the poor people lives with them, and they cannot afford even to educate their children. So it is not a matter of singing the name of Obama, 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 Obama. We need investors.
Kogelo's residents are aware that the U.S. election campaign is unfolding, though the details can take time to get to the remote village. The campaign is being covered extensively in the national newspapers, but they aren't available in Kogelo. Nicholas Rajula, the owner and director of the newly built hotel, has found an alternative way to follow the campaign.
Even in my hotel, we have installed the CNN, the BBC. If you want to watch in the night, people are following the debates.
Community leaders may be watching closely, but most people in the marketplace say they are only aware the elections are coming up. This passing interest may be because they are no longer banking on Obama's success to ensure their economic future. Vitalis Ogombe, chairman of the Obama Kogelo Cultural Center, explains.
If Romney becomes the president, Obama is not elected anymore, we in Kogelo will still forge ahead because we have been sensitized. What Obama did, most importantly to the Kogelo people, was to bring his friends to come. Teach us all sensitized on how to be self-reliant.
Nicholas Rajula believes that Kogelo's fate now lies in the hands of its people.
The euphoria the guy has established, because whether it's the president or it's not the president, the village has gotten the fame in history. And as a businessman, it is up to me now to retain the visitors, look for them, and make sure that I give something different from even the Obama presidency.
But the people of Kogelo are united in what they hope and expect will happen on November 6th. Moses Ojuan, a local carpenter, sums up the general sentiment.
We are much concerned with his election, and we are happy about it. Because he's our person. We see the development, even in America and here. We are happy, so happy.
For Monocle in Kogelo, I'm Sarah Christine Jemson.
We'll be hearing more from Kogelo tomorrow with our Nairobi correspondent, Tristan McConnell, who's travelling out there for Election Day itself. Now, my colleague Steve Bloomfield has been grinning his way through that package and repeating words and phrases and reminiscing in a pretty strong way, because you used to be based in Kenya and you were there 4 years ago. What was it like 4 years ago?
It was fascinating. It was almost better to be there, I think, than here. People in Kenya just loved the fact that Obama was running for election. In fact, all throughout Africa, in the year and a half leading up to Election Day itself, wherever you go to some remote Darfuri village, and the first thing people will say is, "So, who do you think, Obama or Hillary? I think Hillary is better." Yeah, everyone would have a view on it. In Kenya, no one said Hillary was better, aside from one man who lived in Kogelo. Now, we heard from Nicholas Rajula in that package. He was the businessman with a hotel. He was 4 years ago running to be an MP for Kogelo, and he was linking himself to Obama. He was claiming to be Obama's cousin. No one could really prove it, but lots of people there claimed to be his cousin. He said, "I'm going to win. I'm the Obama." His opponent was more experienced, had been the favourite beforehand, didn't think much of this young upstart. And when I met him, said, "If he's the Obama, I am the Hillary." And sure enough, the Hillary actually won there, because you know they favoured a bit of experience.
Speaks volumes that he didn't choose to be the McCain, I think, which yes. we don't even need to go into. No. You're listening to a US election special of Midori House. We'll be right back after this with our guide to the swing states. Stay tuned.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, wants to beckon you onto its intergalactic spaceship of artistic endeavour, zooming you from gallery openings on Mars to concerts on Venus via magazine launches on the outer reaches of the Milky Way. Actually, that's a lie, but it is a truly global mix of art, literature, film, music, media, and the home of the wonderful and well-loved showcase for live music, the Midori House Sessions.
In the backs of buses across Europe and Latin America, we composed a little song.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time.
This is the Midori House election special with Steve Bloomfield and Aisha Spears.
We're back. It's Monday, the 5th of November, and there's one day to go until the US presidential elections. We're here live in New York for this day four of our Midori House election specials. I'm Steve Bloomfield.
And I'm Aisha Spears. We're joined today by Caitlin Thompson, politics editor for WNYC, and our Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg.
Now, as regular listeners will know, Sasha has been guiding us through the swing states each day here on Midori House, and today is no exception. Before we talk more with Sasha and Caitlin, here's Sasha's guide to Wisconsin and Michigan.
I'm Sasha Eisenberg, and here's Monocle's guide to the swing states.
Sasha, let's talk about two states where the Republicans probably thought they might do quite well due to the roots of both their presidential candidate and vice presidential candidate at Michigan and Wisconsin. Let's start with Wisconsin, home state of VP candidate Paul Ryan. Does he have a chance of swinging it for his ticket?
This is the sort of biggest reach on the Romney map. This is a state that has leaned blue over the last few years, where Obama won by double digits in 2008. And I think that the Romney bet on the state is hinges on two things. One is Ryan's appeal. It's a guy who's never run statewide for office, but his congressional district voted for Obama. It's a sort of swing district in the southeast part of the state that they hope Ryan's presence on the ballot can start to move in their direction. The other reason is that they've already had the biggest Republican victory of the year in Wisconsin this year when Scott Walker, the governor, beat back a recall led by labor unions and Democrats. And Wisconsin has just been the most politicized state in the country over the last couple of years, thanks in large part to Walker and in some small part to Ryan. And so it is a place where both sides have spent a lot of time talking to their supporters. It's a state that has high turnout to begin with. Both parties know how to play politics in that state because there have been so many of these recall elections, not just for governor, but for state legislators, all sort of provoked by the tumult that Walker has caused. And so both sides think that they know who their voters are and how to get to them.
And if we look at Michigan, yeah, this is a state where Mitt Romney spent a lot of time during his childhood. You know, his father worked there as the head of General Motors. You would think then that he would have, you know, some sort of sway there, but that hasn't quite worked out for him yet, has it?
No, it's it was sort of on the expanded map, and I think that there's, for sort of sentimental purposes, it's very hard for Romney in particular to give up on it, but by all accounts, they have. He hasn't been visiting it in weeks. They've barely spent a dollar on TV. We've seen this for the last few cycles where Republicans think that Michigan looks winnable, but end up pulling out weeks out, and I think that the state's still a fundamentally Democratic state, and the auto bailout that let Detroit go bankrupt headline that the New York Times put on Romney's op-ed in 2009 has just been really difficult for him to shake off. And so my guess is that in Romney's heart, he'll be holding out hope that it's a state where not just the time he spent there, but where his father is as a well remembered governor will give him some good news on election night. But it's probably not to be.
And at least if he does pull out, he won't have his vice presidential candidate moaning about that decision on TV like John McCain had with Sarah Palin.
That's right. And, you know, and the difference with his running mate is Paul Ryan will be on the ballot in Wisconsin. And so when voters go to the polls in his district, they'll be able to vote for Paul Ryan in two separate places on their ballot, which could offer an extra boost to them in Wisconsin that obviously they don't have in Michigan.
That was Sasha's guide to Wisconsin and Michigan, and we will hear the final part of the guide tomorrow when we visit Ohio and Florida. We're lucky enough to have Sasha in the studio with us today. What are the problems with voting in those states? Are there Florida-style problems?
You know, Florida's significantly improved their processes around voting and voting machines since 2000. So my guess is there's always a problem for broken machines and stuff like that. You know, I think one of the more likely scenarios, if we have to game out what lawyers we're chasing for the next few weeks, is the laws in Ohio are such that provisional ballots, which are if you go into the polling place and there's some issue about your right to vote, your address doesn't match up, or you're not in the right location, or whatever it is, what'll happen is you fill out a what's called a provisional ballot, which then can be contested later by lawyers, but at least it's the vote exists, and then, you know, the burden of proof is on somebody to disqualify it later. The laws in Ohio have it so that those don't get opened for 10 days as a matter of course, regardless of how close the election is. And so, you know, talking to people in both parties, they expect at least 500,000 of these ballots could be filled out, depending on, you know, and every time.
And that could be larger than the margin of victory.
And if that's larger than the margin of victory, then we are sitting around for 10 days where there's no ability for any authority to do anything to those ballots. And the likelihood of having ballots end up cast provisionally increases astronomically when polling places are overrun with lawyers, which is what's happening now on both sides, both with the parties and the campaigns and some of these outside groups like True the Vote on the right, which is very obsessed with sort of voter fraud challenges, and groups on the left that are doing what they call election protection. They're basically playing offensive defense. And so every time there's going to be some sort of incident at the polls, somebody's going to fill out a provisional ballot, and we could wake up on Wednesday where we have a margin of 200,000 votes and we have 300,000 provisional votes, and if Ohio is the pivotal state, then we will have not even the first step towards reconciliation of that for a week and a half.
Caitlin, there's something about elections here which I really struggle to understand. You know, America likes to see itself as the beacon of democracy, as arguably the most democratic place on earth. And yet I then look at what's happening in Ohio and Florida, where you have a Republican Secretary of State who is responsible for the voting and is often doing that, in certainly in these two cases, in what seems to be a very partisan way. We look at this and think, if this was happening in a developing world country, we'd say, oh, I'm not sure about this. We should send in some election monitors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd have the UN on the scene in a heartbeat. It's a little bit embarrassing, frankly. And I think what's interesting right now is we have, you know, having had these past two elections where, you know, obviously Florida and then the Diebold controversy that erupted in Ohio last.
This is the machines.
That people claimed were turning out Republican rigged, votes right. and essentially rigged. You know, it's we're halfway there to total reform, and this has brought in sort of every conversation that we are having nationally in terms of race. So in some cases, you know, we've thrown out some of these new laws because they contradict the voting protection, you know, the Voting Rights Act that was passed in the 50s and 60s to protect minority votes has now been challenged and upheld in different states. So basically the standard is changing across the board. We have some abilities for people in places like Washington that can register to vote in a primary through Facebook. Now we're going to start experiencing New Jerseyans voting by email, which is kind of a great thing based on what we were talking about earlier. There's a way for people to vote whose polling places might have gotten destroyed. But it's crazy across the board. I mean, in our last presidential election here in New York, we had levers where we had, you know, you felt a kind of satisfying actually sound when you pulled the lever for one of your candidates. This time around, we have scanners. And one of the things that is, you know, crazy about this local election is that the people who were supposed to get trained in terms of teaching people how to use these scanners were supposed to get trained last week when we had a hurricane in the city. So basically,
what's wrong with pencil and paper?
Yeah, you know, at a certain point, yeah, let's do some. Let's either go really old school and do purple thumbs like the Iraqis, or let's go really new school and scan everyone's eyeballs. You know, if we can send people into space, why can't we? Why can't we figure out, you know, optic scan voting or something like that?
I will say that the courts this year have served in almost every instance as a check on what seemed to be the most aggressive efforts by state legislatures and you know, whether it's secretaries of state or governors to change voting laws in what seemed like the most rash ways possible for short-term political gain. And so, you know, part of that at the federal level is you do have a Justice Department that's been very aggressive in using its civil rights authority in states that are covered by the Civil Rights Act to maintain access to voting. But I think you look back at this year in total and you can say the system isn't as dysfunctional in terms of the election authorities being politicized or partisan, in part because the courts have, in most places, you know, been like very rational, and you know, in most states saying like, yeah, it's, you know, there can be good reasons to make people show an ID, but mm-hmm. you don't have to impose this law in 6 weeks without creating, you know, necessary remedies for people that don't have IDs. And so, you know, I think this year could have turned out to be a lot more dysfunctional than it has.
Sasha, Caitlin, thank you very much. You're listening to a Midori House special live from New York. We're back in a moment.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Just coming up to 13:53 here in New York.
And it's time for our daily polling update. And with just one day to go until the election, it's time, I think, for us to spell out exactly what Mitt Romney would need to do to win the 270 electoral college votes needed to secure the White House. To help us, I'm very pleased to welcome back Julia Clark, Vice President of Ipsos, who joins us again on the line from Washington. Julia, welcome back to Midori House. Tell us, how can Romney actually win? What is his route to 270?
Romney's only route to 270 electoral college votes is to win the big four swing states, Florida, Ohio, Virginia, Colorado, and a wild card. He needs maybe a Wisconsin or an Iowa and a New Hampshire. I mean, the electoral math is very much favoring Obama right now. Romney would really have to sweep all swing states in order to pull this off.
A lot of people in Romney's camp are talking about how the polls look really good for him in Ohio and all their internal polling is looking good for them. Is that just a kind of pep rally for him to not feel too bad about himself, or do you see that there could be a chance in Ohio for him to really get where he needs to be?
None of the polls I've seen suggest that Romney is going to win Ohio. For a couple of weeks now, it's been trending towards Obama, and our latest poll gives him a 4-point lead in Ohio, as do many of the other polls we've seen. I think every party, you know, suggests that their internal polls show better numbers than any polls anybody else is seeing, and I would treat that with a very large grain of salt. But I would say Ohio seems to be pretty comfortably in Obama's camp at this point, and that creates an even more difficult path for Romney to succeed.
Sasha, if Romney can't win Ohio, does he have any chance whatsoever? What does he really need to do then?
I mean, we could come up with a whole list of states that he could win and get to 270. I mean, you know, the thing we tend to see is that, you know, the demographics in states are slightly different, but national voting blocks tend to move the same way. And so the type of thing that would move Wisconsin would move Ohio. And so it's hard to imagine, you know, one state breaking dramatically one way in the closing days of the race and the other one's not doing that. You know, I mean, at the core, and I think there is some honesty to what the Romney people say about their internal polling. They have just run this whole race with a theory of what the electorate will look like in 2012 that is, first of all, radically different from what the Obama campaign's theory of the electorate is. And that's one reason why it's not matching up with the polling. And if we see differences in polls day to day, it's not necessarily that people are seeing voter support in different ways. It's just that who you include in your sample based on what your assumption of the entire universe of voters who turn out tomorrow is. And the Romney people have had a very, you know, lowercase and capitalcase C conservative idea of who's going to be going to the polls tomorrow.
Julia, often when it gets this stage in election, you know a campaign's doing badly if they say, no, the polls are all wrong, the polls are all wrong. But occasionally they are. If we were to go back to 1992 in the UK, it said that the Labour Party there was going to win and actually the Conservatives won. And when they analysed afterwards, they said what it was there was this spiral of silence where people were embarrassed to say they wanted to vote for the Conservatives because they'd been in power for 13 years. People were tired of them. They didn't want to admit it, but they did end up voting for them. Do you have any worries at all that there could be anything similar here where people have been a little cautious about saying they wanted to back Romney?
Look, I don't think we have a shy Tory phenomenon here. I'm obviously very familiar with the 92 results. We actually haven't seen quite such a disaster in national election polling, at least in the U.S., as 92 was in the U.K. There's a huge, much larger volume of data available in the U.S., by which I mean there are just many more pollsters. There are 5 or 6 in the U.K., and there are about 40 or 50 here in the U.S., and so you see a lot more data, which makes the process by nature a little bit more transparent. I don't think we're seeing a situation where people are unwilling to admit they're going to vote for one candidate or the other. It per your other colleague's point, it does come down to the swing states. And I think Ohio, as I mentioned before, is probably falling towards Obama, but I think Virginia is actually the one to look at early in the evening tomorrow night. I do think if Virginia ends up going to Obama, you know, it is sort of the end game in many ways. Romney's math just won't really be able to add up unless he wins some states that are already very comfortably called into the Obama camp by the polls, of course. And I mean, I think the point of what you're saying is that can we trust the polls? But I mean, I'm a pollster, so of course I would say you can trust the polls. But they have an excellent record in the United States, and I don't just mean my own. I mean, in general, polling here is pretty good.
Julia Clark from Ipsos, don't you worry, we will bring you back after the election result is known to see whether you were right or wrong. Thank you very much for joining us. That was Julia Clark from Ipsos in Washington, D.C. That's all we have time for today. Thank you very much to both our guests here in New York, Caitlin Thompson, politics editor for WNYC, and thanks also to our Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg, who I must say has the best intro music in all of Monocle 24.
The member of the Rat Pack from Monocle 24. Our engineer on this side of the Atlantic was the lovely Paul Ruest here at Argo Studios. Our producer was Katie Bilboa with big help from Barrett Austin, and our researcher was Pauline Eiferman.
In London, our studio engineer was Toby Hammond. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow for the big day itself. That's 1300 hours on the East Coast. And if you can't wait for that, we'll be continuing our election coverage tonight on the Monocle Daily, 2200 in London, 1700 here in New York. But for now, it's goodbye from us here in New York. I'm Steve Bloomfield.
And I'm Aisha Spears.
Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.